Okay, everyone. Hello and welcome to this section on HTML5 for Extension Tool CS76. I'm Tom Barrasso, teaching assistant or course assistant, whatever you know the title goes. Not to be confused with Tommy McWilliam, the head teaching fellow. So I just thought that I'd start off with a brief introduction to what HTML5 is again, just because it's such a there's such a gray area as to what people are considering HTML5. I'll also be talking about CSS3, which is not to be confused with HTML5. They do sort of go hand in hand in terms of the front end sort of standard from the W3C in terms of each technology and what it'll offer, but they are not one and the same. I just picked some quotes online. HTML is currently under development as the next major revision of the HTML standard. I don't think there's much debate in that statement here. Just saying that the W3C has pushed a new standard that they're working on, HTML5 draft. Emerging web content delivery platform, the source specifically said in 2010, that may replace technologies like Flash on mobile devices. I think we saw this with Adobe sort of backing out of the mobile Flash industry when they said we're done making new releases of our software for mobile devices. It's true that HTML5 has been especially increasingly popular for mobile devices. And then another one that's just mentioned, it's the upcoming powerful standard of hypertext markup language, HTML, which has added advanced interactive features such as allowing videos to be embedded in a web page. That's just exemplifying one of the new features that comes along with HTML5. And also, if at any point you have any questions, just feel free to raise your hand. Here's a few examples of ways in which HTML5, or how it will actually look. So in terms of what the developer is seeing, if you're making a web page, you might be familiar with this doc type at the top of your page. And if you're familiar with XHTML, you'll know how absurdly long it can be. You had to include all of this information that you see in the first example. That's all been simplified down to the second part, doc type HTML. It's a lot simpler to remember. No need to Google it every time you want to figure it out. No copy paste. It just makes life easier. And then another example of using a char set, which is short for a character set. So if you want to specify what type of characters you're going to be using in your web page, you might need to specify if you're using like Japanese characters in particular, Unicode characters, or just ASCII. That's also been simplified greatly. So just some examples as some of the new things that HTML5 is going to has. And the ways in which it can simplify your development. Local storage, I think Dan covered a lot of this. I have my own example as well. It's a lot more mundane. It does include the example that we mentioned talking about how to determine whether or not you've exceeded your limit. So most browsers impose a sort of de facto limit of 5 megabytes. There is actually no limit according to the standards, so browsers could change this. But what seems to be the case on most browsers, including Chrome, Firefox, and even the mobile devices, is that 5 megabytes, you're pretty much guaranteed to get at least that. And the user can sometimes, they'll get a pop-up, I know in Firefox this is the case, asking if they want to allow the website to have more storage. And the website can request to store even more information should it need it. There's APIs. I'm sorry. Yep.
Didn't make really sense, but we saw in the lecture, code examples, a lot of interplay between JavaScript and HTML5.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is there a parallel standard for JavaScript, or is there a relationship between JavaScript standard and HTML5?
All right, so the question is there a relationship between the HTML5 and JavaScript, so the new standard of HTML5? And the answer to that is yes and no. It's surprisingly more of a gray area than when it comes to CSS3 and HTML5, where there's sort of a definite CSS standard and a definite HTML standard. In the case of JavaScript, there is a great deal of overlap in terms of the APIs and how they're supposed to look. Obviously, the implementations are browser-specific, but there is also something called the ECMA standards, which are just another standard body which more defines the JavaScript language. So if there's changes to the language itself, that would be found in an ECMA different version draft. But as far as the APIs go for JavaScript in terms of a web browser, that should be covered under HTML5. So I'd say yes and no. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
So as I was just mentioning, all right.
The
Yeah, exactly. So I should clarify that. That 5 megabyte, so the question is that 5 megabytes, is that for the domain that you're using? And yes, it is. The domain, each domain gets 5 megabytes at a minimum. And that, well, again, that's the de facto limit. There is no standard, but pretty much what we see across all browsers is at least 5 megabytes. And that is just for your domain. And then another domain can have another 5 megabytes, so on and so forth. All right, well, then we'll move on. Just we briefly mentioned that there are methods for setting and retrieving information from these key value pairs. There's also methods for removing. So if you do run out of storage, one option might just be to remove some data, you know, if you're sort of running out of space. And Dan mentioned that there is no concept of types. You just have a string that you can store. So your key and your value are going to be a string. If you store an integer or an object, it's up to you to serialize that and figure out how you're going to go from the object to the string and then back. We have a question?
So who does the cleaning once we reach that 5 megabytes?
All right, so who does the cleaning once you reach that limit, often being 5 megabytes? Well, you do. So you're going to, as you'll see in an example later, well, you're not actually going to, I'm not going to hit the limit of my example, but the case is you will be able to know when you've reached your limit. And if you have, it's up to you to clean stuff out. Otherwise, you just won't be able to store anything else inside of it.
When you say you, you mean the programmer?
Yes, the program. So this you is the programmer. If you're calling set item, and you're trying to store new information and you've already exceeded your limit, the browser will just not allow you to set that information. It will not be saved. All right, so I'm going to move to my simple demo here. All right, so I'm just going to rerun this. And we'll look at the source here. So something's odd, right? You know, that doesn't quite make sense. So we'll look at to see why this comes up the way it does. Hopefully this is visible. I can make this full screen. Is that big enough? All right. So just your standard HTML5 document, nothing new here, your title. I've attached my listener, instead of doing body on load, there's a more graceful way of doing this. I made it a little overly complicated, but in short, the way of doing this inside JavaScript in and of itself is just better in case the browser doesn't support JavaScript at all, so that you won't have any strange behaviors going on. That's not strictly necessary. That was just my trying to be clean and observing best practices. Now I'm just doing some basic stuff. So I have an element here which has an ID of name. We can see that right here, an empty paragraph with an ID of name. And then we sort of run through this little check. I mentioned that the example that Dan gave you is a better implementation of checking whether the browser supports, say, local storage or geolocation, just because if you surround it with a try-catch block, you can know if there was an error that has occurred. In this case, if the browser doesn't support local storage, you're going to get an error and nothing will execute after that line. And obviously, we don't necessarily want that. So moving from there, I heard this question. Someone asked a question earlier if we could have some sort of local storage that was sort of page specific. So if you could have something, you know, if you have one page and you want to store something with the same name or key, and then you have another page that you want to do the same key with, a very simple way to do it would just be to use this object here, document.location.pathname. And if you're on index.php, it would be index.php. If you navigate to a subpage, say subpage.php, it would be that. So for every different page that you have, you're going to get a different path name. And that way, if you just append that or prefix it to your keys, they'll always be unique to each page. Now, we're going to be setting an item here. We're going to call this item name. And the value is your professor is David Malin. But that's not what we saw, right? So we'll go through this and we'll see that what we're doing here, if you remember, Dan mentioned that if you call the get item on and you pass it a key, it'll return null. In this case, we know it's not going to be null because we just set that value. So, you know, we've gotten through. And now we're going to set it again. This is the way that you override something, just by calling set item again with the same key and passing a new value. So that's pretty much how it handles it. There's no update. It's just set. Then we're going to take that item again, and we're going to make it the content of that paragraph element. And now, in this case, you see that we have the swapped name. And then finally, I put in an example of how to remove the item. It's pretty simple. There is a remove item method, and you pass it the key, and all of a sudden, you now have more space, and that item is gone from the user's machine. And then finally, we reach to the bottom. We'll note that this whole thing is surrounded in a try-catch. So everything in which we're storing and retrieving. Well, at the end of this try-catch, we're doing a simple check. If the error is equal to this type of this specific error, quota exceeded ERR, which is a standard. You can research more to get a little bit more information on it, but this is the basic way of how you would intercept or interpret knowing whether or not you've exceeded your limit. And if the error is of that type, we're just going to say we've ran out of storage. But what you might want to do is something like remove item, blah, 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 you know, or you might want to get the item, do some sort of cutting off of it and shortening it and remove it. But that's completely up to the developer as to how you're going to remove that data. Any questions there, or are we good to move on to the next section?
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to get a list of all the keys so you know, like, oh, I can get rid of that, or you know what I mean? Like, what if you don't know? Well, you should know, I suppose. But is there a way to get a list of all the keys?
All right, so is there a way to get a list of all of the keys in which you're storing in local storage? I do not know off the top of my head. I've never heard of that, and I do agree with the point that you made that you probably should know the keys just as best practices because you're storing the information. If you do it too dynamically, you're likely to run out of storage because you're not keeping track of what you're storing. So there may or may not be. I'm not entirely sure, but if there is, I'd advise you not to use it or to be very cautious with using it. Another question? So the question was, can you access this local storage similar to how PHP does with an associative array using integers? So 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, so on and so forth. I believe you could. The example that Dan gave where he had those square brackets, if you passed it 0, it would probably be typecasted to a string. And in that way, you would be storing it with a key with a string of 0. Again, I'm not sure that's really good practices because then you're sort of looking at indefinitely growing sets of data, but it's likely possible, or you could just implement your own simple method of doing that. You know, if you keep track, if you had, let's say, a key, like keys, you made a key keys, and then you could get all of your keys if you paid attention to when you were storing them. So you could very simply implement that. You know, it's based on the context of what you're building. And again, be careful if you're doing something like this. You don't want your data to grow out of control. Where did that go? I guess we'll move on with the PDF. All right, so that was just the basics of local storage. I don't have a demo for this, but I have just some basic source code here of how you can include audio or video in your web page. So the HTML5 standard does include a new API for both of these features. So including audio, like an MP3 file or an Ogthiora file, or embedding video of a certain size, like or file type of MP4. And then I gave an example that you can, or I mentioned that if your tag is not self-closing. We covered that if your tag is self-closing, it ends with a slash, or in HTML5, we see this video tag is actually self-closing because you no longer have to include that slash. That was an XHTML thing. If it is like the video tag, there is no fallback, meaning if your browser does not support that file type, nothing will happen, or they might just be given an area, like a box that says file type not supported or something that's browser specific. Or in the example of the audio tag that I put, ironically named movie.og, you could put something inside of it like a paragraph that says your browser does not support audio, and then if the browser doesn't understand this tag, it will then go ahead and present this paragraph. And then the user will see, oh, shucks, my browser doesn't support audio. Guess I got to upgrade. And I made a point about codecs. It's very important to pay attention to the codecs and to have multiple fallbacks, just because, unfortunately, there is no real standard governing the codecs in which you can use. So some browsers might support DRM content or MP4 files, etc. Some may support OGG files. Some may support both. Some may support neither. So you really want to have an array of formats that you can offer your user. Otherwise, they might be left out in the cold. Any questions here, or we're good to move on? All right. Like I said, there's no example for that, but you can test if you have some local videos at your house. You can make a little HTML page for that. So again, Dan touched upon geolocation. He pretty much covered everything that you might need to go over. You have the ability to request the user's location, giving you a minimal amount of a latitude, a longitude, and an accuracy in some sort of meters. Often that's 30 if you're using some sort of cellular triangulation. If you're using Wi-Fi or Ethernet, it might be even less accurate. Oftentimes, this seems to be the standard in most browsers, that there will be a pop-up or an alert box in some way that will allow you to accept or deny this domain from requesting your information. We had a question concerning security and whether or not the user could then send this to a server. And the reason that it's that you ask for permission, even if you don't send it to a server, is just because the browser may not know exactly what you're doing with this data, and to try to intercept every time you're passing a latitude or longitude would be very difficult. So it's just best to ask when you're asking for it at all. And that way the user has a good sense of, why does this need my location? You could be going to, some recipe site, and why does it need your location? So it's just best to ask when the web page is asking for your location. And then, as I mentioned, there's also the ability to cache an error. So if your browser errors out at some point trying to fetch your location, then you can then handle the various types of errors, see if the user did not give you permission. And for this, I also have another demo, which I do not believe is going to work right now. I got the error timed out last time because I'm not connected to a wireless network, and my laptop doesn't have a GPS. But if I was to put a phone under here, you saw with Dan the ability to retrieve this information. Here's the pop-up that I was mentioning. So I could deny this once. I could do share location now, or I could add some sort of exception in my browser's preferences to always allow this domain to access my information. The reason that probably doesn't pop up here is because I'm using locally served up HTML files. So obviously there is no concept of domain when you're on your local file system. So I could go ahead and say share, but it's probably going to time out because I'm not connected anywhere. If we're to look at the source code for this example, again, pretty much your standard HTML5 stuff. We have our title, similar pattern to what we saw before, how we're attaching this onload function. Again, you want to use Dan's example of how to handle whether or not the browser supports this feature, just because we don't want to get an error. And then we do that simple get current position, passing in a function for if we were successful locate, or an error handling function. Our error handling function pretty much just checks if our message is a string, just output it directly. If it's not, we'll look at one of these possible cases. It could be a timeout, the position could just be unavailable, or the user could specifically deny this website access to this their location. And then a general unknown handler. It's pretty much the same thing that we saw with Dan. Here's just a way of retrieving the latitude and longitude, and then we just output it to the DOM. Should all be pretty simple generic stuff here. Any questions on this? All right, now we get to move into the really interesting stuff, the CSS3. So this is the CSS3 is, as I mentioned, separate from HTML5.
Mm-hmm. Suppose that the user denies permission to the website. So how do we reset that? Other than the user going to the browser settings and removing that.
All right. So how does the user remove that? So if the user denies your website access to their location, how do they go ahead and remove that and change that later? So as I showed you, here, when we refresh this, you can reject it once. Again, I think it's going to time out because of some weird thing that Firefox is doing right now with not being connected to any sort of network at all. But what usually would be the case is you reject it once, or you would go into preferences in your browser, and there's some sort of preference. It might be under content. I don't know in particular where it is in the case of Firefox. It might be under some sort of history or cache. I think Dan showed in Chrome where it is. If you go through the settings, you can go through content and then the preferences that you have for each website. So even if you say reject always or accept always, you are able to change that later. All right. So as I mentioned, CSS3, separate from HTML5. CSS is short for cascading style sheets, and it's how we style a page. Basically, it's how we change the color, the position, the shape, all sorts of things on our page, and how we present the content that we have. So, you know, some things that I just touched upon. Some example features that are now included in CSS3 include animations, image and color manipulation. So you have the ability now to have opaque colors. You can actually set transparency in the colors so that backgrounds don't have to be a solid black or white. They can be some opacity as you're dragging them around. If you're, you know, if that's the kind of website you're building where you can drag, like, you know, parts around on the web page, they can change their opacity to show that. The ability to support fonts, so to support fonts that the browser doesn't already have. Borders, the ability to manipulate borders, have multiple colors, use images as borders, so on, have shadows. I put a note here about vendor-specific prefixes, and this is pretty important, and you'll see this in my example. But so a lot of these features in browser support are deemed experimental, and as a way of showing that, the way of accessing them is through vendor-specific prefixes. You can pretty much determine which ones go to which browser. MS Microsoft, Moz, short for Mozilla, Mozilla Firefox. WebKit is for Chrome and Safari. O for Opera. Those are pretty much all the ones that you need to touch upon. So pretty much anytime you see a property that's supported in CSS3, you're going to want to look into vendor-specific prefixes with that property as well, just to ensure that every single browser is going to see the same animation should that browser support it. That same color, etc. And most modern browsers support most of the new CSS3 features. And we're talking Firefox, Chrome, Safari, IE9. Although historically, a lot of older browsers like IE8 and further behind that did not always support a lot of the features, and they still don't support every one of them. I put a link to Quirks Mode, a great website that has a table of a number of different browsers and different browser versions, as well, pointing to which CSS3 features they support, which they don't, if they have partial support, if they use vendor-specific prefixes for that support, so on. Any questions with that so far?
Yeah, I'm confused about what you mean by vendor-specific prefixes. You mean in the actual CSS text, you've got...
All right, so you're confused at what exactly I'm referring to by vendor-specific prefixes, and I can show you a code example for this. Here's my CSS3 example. And this is where it gets kind of messy here, but... you can see here that there's this transform property in CSS, similar to how we have a height property, et cetera, et cetera. And now we have these prefixes with these hyphens, and then we have some sort of the prefix inside of it, like O, MS, Moz, et cetera. And this is what I'm referring to by prefix. These are all separate properties. In this case, only Mozilla Firefox will interpret this one. In this case, only WebKit-based browsers like Safari or Chrome will interpret this one. This one would be interpreted, the standard would be interpreted by browsers that no longer consider this support experimental, and they've moved to using the standard. So it does get to be a mess, and it can be a pain because you're repeating yourself 5 times over, and in a few minutes I'm going to show you a god-awful example of where this gets really messy, because if we're doing complicated animations that use keyframes, you're going to be repeating the same thing over dozens and dozens of times. So it gets very tedious, but this is unfortunately what we have to accept if we want to support a wide array of browsers. I hope does that answer your question? All right. So I mentioned, oh, I'm sorry. So your question is in regards to the compatibility of CSS3 and HTML5, how they connect, or all right. So that's pretty much based on the browser itself. Most browsers that support a lot of HTML features, including the video, the geolocation, etc., do support most of the CSS3 features. And I say most being the keyword because there are a few exceptions to this rule, and often they can be very odd. Sometimes it'd be a bug in the browser that causes it to not support it. Sometimes the browser just omitted this feature for whatever reason. So by and large, there is a lot of overlap. If the browser supports a lot of HTML5 features, it supports a lot of CSS3 features. But just be careful and maybe check out that table at Quirks Mode. Just be aware that it's not always guaranteed to be the case. Yeah, exactly. So you can use HTML5 and or XHTML and CSS3. They're not interconnected. You don't always have to use CSS3 with HTML5 or vice versa. The browser, if it implements it, should use it for whatever version of HTML or CSS you're using. I hope that didn't get too complicated. So one of the examples of new features are border manipulation. And some examples of that you can have multicolored borders to the point where you can almost make a gradient effect. And I put the link under multicolored points to CSS3 info. And they have it's a website. They have a number of previews of the CSS3 features. And if your browser supports them, it's great. I mean, you can see a ton of different examples of pretty much how to use a number of new features. Radii manipulation, so manipulating the radius of the border. You can do this to each specific border or to all four borders at once. The example that I have below shows you both vendor-specific prefixes and, in particular, manipulating border radius. So back in the day of HTML 4.0 and XHTML, what you used to have to do, you'd have to have four images to get rounded corners, a top left, a top right, bottom left, bottom right, of each being a rounded image, and then you'd have to have the colors line up properly. And it was just a mess. And now with CSS3, you have the ability to dynamically round the corners of any element. So this could be an image. You can have the image get nice rounded corners. This could be just a colorful box. It could just have a colorful border, pretty much anything. So that is a simple example there. And then shadows, I briefly mentioned. It's not in one of my examples, but shadows, you can change like a drop shadow. So sometimes if you're carrying a window around in your OS, you might notice at the very bottom, the border of the window, you'll have this little shadow that overcasts it. So you can sort of implement that very same feature now with CSS3. And there are new color schemes that are supported by CSS3 as well. I put a link to Wikipedia for HSL, hue, saturation, and light. And then HSLA is just the same thing with an alpha component, so changing the opacity. RGBA, red, green, blue, and then alpha. So again, the ability to change the opacity of this color, which is very, it's a cool thing to have. HSL, not necessarily practical for most applications, but there are certain use cases where if you're doing some sort of image manipulation or something, you might want to have HSL for that. It's good to have. I don't know the support across browsers yet. As far as I know, IE9 didn't support it from the last I've heard. So that's one of the standards that's catching on a little bit later. RGBA seems to be supported across all modern browsers. And there is an old fallback for Internet Explorer. And I provided a simple example here, how you could have the background color be 50% opaque. So the last parameter in this RGBA is from 0 to 1. It's this floating point number. And in this case, it's 0.5. It's going to be 50%. And then you have your pretty much standard RGB here, whatever color that turns out to be. And then I gave an example of where you might use this. If you were to fade something in and out, this is like if you're trying to make the illusion or the effect of an animation, this can be particularly useful. The ability to manipulate text is a new CSS3 feature. You can include text shadows, word wrapping, so if the words are too long to fit in an area, sort of cut the word or at the edge and put it to the next line. Do ellipsize, so if your line is running too long, you can dynamically have these dots generated for you. provide a simple example here, how you might have a shadow underneath your text, and then it would get cut off if it's a little too long. And then transformations, and this is where we're going to get into the demonstration. And I'm sure that you'll like that a little bit more than just me talking here. So there is a transform property, and it allows you to manipulate the scale, rotation, or position of an element. So you can call translate, and you can move it along an x and y coordinate relative to where it would naturally be. Scale is, as it sounds, you're scaling the element up or down. So the way that works is you can pass a percentage like 100%, 150%, or you can pass a number like 1.5 to represent 150%, sort of like how we saw before with the opacity. And then there's the ability to rotate using either degrees or radians. And you just append DEG or RAD to the end of a number to tell the browser, this is the unit that I'm using here. And that's just for rotating it, you know, 360 degrees or 2 pi around a circle. And, all right, we'll look at the, I'll show the source for the first part of this example. I need to zoom out a bit because the resolution's a little bit low here. And then we'll zoom in afterwards. But you can see here that we have some text that's rotated. It's very simple, and we'll look into the source behind this. This is what I was using earlier as the example of vendor-specific prefixes. Well, we have, for 5 different browsers here, the rotation of negative 90 degrees. So we're rotating what should be text that is vertically, from left to right, and we're rotating at negative 90 degrees. These are just a bunch of stylistic specific things to change, you know, the type of font, the size, etc. That's just relative to this example. But, here I provide the example of rotation. You could also scale it up or down. I can do that pretty much right here, right now. So I'm only going to edit the Mozilla one just because I'm using Firefox. But if I want to make this smaller, I could make the scale 0.5 and then refresh. And there you go. Now it's a lot smaller. Or I mentioned that you can translate. You have two coordinates here, an x and a y, and you use some sort of unit of measurement. So I could push this over 50 pixels. I could move it 50 pixels to the left and then not move it in terms of y. And we'll see if this is, if I change this negative 50 to a 50, it should move. And did you notice how it moved? It moved up and down. That's because it's been rotated negative 90 degrees. What's now become left or right or x or y is up or down in terms of what we're seeing on the page. And the way that we could see this is if I left this at 50 and then I manipulated the y to be 50, all of a sudden it shifted to the right. So sometimes be careful when you're using a number of CSS3 features like transformations in conjunction. You have to pay attention to exactly what you're doing. If you're rotating things and you're manipulating their position, for example, the coordinate system might change. So just pay attention to when you're doing that. All right, any issues so far, or we're all good? All right, I didn't lose too many people yet.
Could you have overlapped all the that text that's up and straightened down over the ones that were horizontal? Like if you kept them bumping mm-hmm. down the same 50 pixels to the... Mm-hmm.
All right, so are you asking, could I have moved it off screen? Or?
Like to just stick it right down the center of that page. And so you actually have text that's overlapping text.
Oh, yes.
They act like blocks where it's going to push the whole thing over.
Oh, yes. So the question is, can I have it to the, so it's overlapping and they're like blocks and that the page gets pushed over? Yeah, like a cross. So what I did is I made the position absolute, which is a specific property. And this means that all other elements in this page are going to ignore where I position this. But it is possible that I remove this, and then I go through the time of calculating how I'm going to lay things out. And you could have overlapping text along the X or Y based on how you set your positions. So just if you want to do something like that, you're either going to want to have everything be absolutely positioned or nothing. Otherwise, you're going to have trouble figuring out why this one's all the way over here and this one's down here, why they're not flowing with one another, so on and so forth.
When it goes over video, the flash video, so is it goes underneath or over it?
So would it go underneath or overneath flash video? And again, that's up to you. So if you what usually happens is you have a z-index property. So there is this z-index property that I could set to be, say, 100. And if I set the flash video z-index to anything lower than 100, this would be over it. Another way is z-indexes are naturally higher for elements found later in the page. So if I put this after the element for the flash video, it would also be over it based on how you position it. So again, that's entirely up to how you position your elements. All right, so now you see how these things can come together, and you might be able to make an overlay on top of a flash video or something, or have like an image fallback in case the browser doesn't support any sort of video whatsoever. Although if they don't support any sorts of video or flash, well, then they probably don't support CSS3. So this next example I have is using a text shadow here. And it's, you know, it's pretty simple. There's just a text here. We'll see in the code it's a paragraph. Just says the roof is on fire. And here it is. You have this sort of fiery effect. And the reason that I did this way is because I wanted to exemplify using multiple text shadows. So you see how it goes from like a yellowy to an orangey to almost a reddish pinkish. And we're essentially what we're doing is we're telling it to have these different text shadows at different positions. So again, you can look at CSS3 for more examples. That's where I found this one. I just manipulated a little bit, and then you can change the position relative to the text of how far off you want the shadow to be as the first two parameters. The third parameter is another unit on how much you want it to be blurred, so how much you want to stretch the shadow outwards, and then your color. So you can have some sort of hex, RGB, or RGBA, and now that there's this new color scheme. You could even have opaque text shadows. Are we all good with this example so far? You can look at the specs if you really need to see every, why this exactly works. And they're comma separated, as you can see. So each separate shadow, you have four arguments here. You have your X, your Y, your blur, your color, and then you can comma separate them and chain them all together. Now we have this box here, and this box changes colors, and it fades in and out as you hover over it. And this is an example of CSS3 animations. So it's also an example of a border radius. I mentioned that you can manipulate the radii of the border. In this case, it's 12 pixels here. Oh, well, we're going to get that overlapping. It's good. Yeah. So we have this rounded radius border, and we have this fade effect. There's a transition property, and again, vendor-specific prefixes here. This is the simplest of all forms. I mentioned that the easing method and the delay are optional, and they've been omitted in this example. So you can specify the delay in which you want this animation to kick in, or you can specify the easing function, like if you wanted it to go through like some sort of exponential increase in translation or in color manipulation, or if you want it to be linear, which is what it is by default. In this case, we're manipulating the background color, and we're giving a duration of 2 seconds. We're also manipulating the border color with a duration of 2 seconds. And again, comma separation in between what we're sort of chaining different property manipulation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question is, what fires that transition? And it is based on the action that occurs. So later we see right here, we have this hover pseudo class, and we change the values here. I believe the transition is just going to take effect on any sort of change. So if you were to click it, it would also change it. The way to avoid that would be if you didn't want it to do this when it was clicked, you'd have a different pseudo class, and you'd have the same colors, so that way it's transitioning to itself, and the browser won't do anything. Otherwise, it pretty much figures out naturally that it's going to do something. It could be hover, or it could be some other pseudo event. All right, so hopefully we're all fine with this, because the last example is going to get significantly more complicated. I don't know if you'll notice. Maybe if I zoom in enough and try to get rid of this. Oh, did I get rid of everything? I may have. It's not what I want to do. Let me go back to my CSS3. All right, let me manipulate this. All right, so for the sake of the next example, we will just remove that sort of centered, rotated text. And I don't know if you noticed this very subtle animation of like the flame sort of moving up and down. This is using CSS keyframes, CSS3 keyframes. And now I do know that's, I'm not sure on the exact support across all browsers, but I do know that it's sort of another prevailing technology or prevailing API, so its support is a little bit weaker than some other CSS3 features. I'm not sure about IE9. I know that some of the later versions of Firefox, like 9 and 10, the latest version of Chrome, support it. So I provided an example here of, I mentioned that it's going to get extraordinarily tedious to have all these vendor-specific prefixes. Well, you even have to have prefixes for these things like keyframes. So this is very strange-looking CSS syntax. Then we also have to have one for Mozilla. Same thing. Then we have to have one for WebKit. Same thing. And if we want to support this across Opera and IE9, if it had it, or every other browser, we would have to do this again for MS and for Opera and so on and so forth. And this is where having these vendor-specific prefixes just get, sometimes they just get out of hand. You might want to even make some sort of backend that dynamically generates these or something. But for the sake of this, the syntax in terms of the standard is that you have this at, and then you have this keyword keyframes. Then you declare the name of your keyframe. It's sort of like the key if you were to have a key value pair with your local storage, but this is how you're going to identify this animation. And then instead of using normal selectors like an ID, we're going to use percentages. So we see that we go 0%, 25%, 50%, 75, and 100. You can do any increment. You could do 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 if you had the patience to actually go through every single one. For this example, I did not. But essentially, what we're doing is we're shifting. You see the values 0 here, it's 2 here, it's 4 here. We're shifting X and Y, these text shadows, and we're changing the blur of the colors to give the effect of a flame moving. And the way that we tell the browser, I want to use this animation, as we scroll further down, is with the animation property. So again, Moz animation, WebKit animation. Here's where we use our keyword, the name of our keyframe, in this case, burn. We're going to give it a duration of 1 second, at which point it will reset or stop. The last parameter, infinite, dictates whether or not it will continuously animate or if it will just stop once it's completed once. You can pass it a delay, in this case 0 seconds. And then I mentioned an easing function. It'll ease in and out, so it'll go up and then it'll go back down. It'll keep doing this over and over and over to provide you this nice illusion of having fiery text on your web page. All right, so if we have any other questions, I'd be glad to take them, or if you want to ask them off screen. Mm-hmm. So do mobile devices support this functionality? I'm going to just venture out and say that it depends on your mobile device. I'd probably say that the iOS 5 absolutely should support this. The latest version of Android 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich probably does in its browser. I haven't tested this specifically, so I can't guarantee it. And I do know that, again, I said it's more cutting edge in that I believe Opera just recently gained support for this, whereas Firefox and Safari and Chrome have had this for quite some time, probably over a year now. And again, you may or may not have to use those vendor-specific prefixes. So I just say test it on the device that you're working with to see whether or not it actually does. All right, then. If there's no other questions, you can ask them afterwards off screen, and thank you for coming to section.